Welcome to Home Lab Highlights, the show that surfaces practical home lab wins and useful self-hosted tools. Docker's out with a major update to their hardened images program today. They're calling it a push to make zero CVEs the new default, and it's a pretty substantial expansion of what they've been building for the last year.
Yeah, the core idea is building more of the software stack from source themselves. They've introduced Docker-hardened system packages, which means they're now building and patching the actual system packages inside Alpine and Debian images, not just the base layers. The claim is they patch faster than upstream distributions, and the guarantees extend even when you customize images.
Right. And they're extending that to end-of-life software, too, with extended lifecycle support. They mention MinIO specifically. Since Upstream archived the project in February, Docker's keeping it patched in their catalog for up to 5 more years. For a home lab, that's interesting if you're running something that's been abandoned, but you're not ready to migrate.
The other piece is policy enforcement moving to developer machines through Docker Scout. It's their existing tool, but now with policies written in Rego that can run locally in the CLI, not just in CI. The underlying problem of supply chain attacks hitting tools like Trivy and Kix this year is real, and Docker's betting this is how you actually hold the line.
On a different note, DuckDB has a preview of version 2.0 up on their site. The announcement is light on specifics, but it's a heads up that the next major release of the embedded analytical database is coming.
And a quick aside on the eternal struggle. Someone posted about their self-hosted email server suddenly bouncing messages from Outlook.com with that classic S3150 blocklist error. The community advice in the thread is the usual mix of checking your entire subnet's reputation and the pragmatic fallback of relaying outbound mail through a smart host while keeping inbound self-hosted. One commenter made a really useful distinction. They pointed out that the DList portal checks your single IP, but S3150 is a block on the entire net block it sits in, so you can check clean while mail still bounces. That's why the provider is often the only real door here. The original poster noted they'd been running fine for years before the sudden block. That's the frustrating part of self-hosted email. Your reputation can change overnight based on factors outside your control, like another user on your ISP's subnet getting compromised. The smart host recommendation isn't giving up, it's just pragmatic risk management. One more thing on Docker. They mentioned the catalog has grown past 4,000 hardened images, plus MCP servers and Helm charts. It's drawing more than 3.5 million pulls a week, with over 1 million builds running regularly to keep all of it patched. That's a significant chunk of the Docker ecosystem moving from a niche security offering to something approaching a default for a lot of common workloads.
Let's talk about a really tangible win for repairable hardware and alternative mobile operating systems. Over on catcrafts.net, there's a post detailing how they got the main camera working on a Fairphone 6 running Postmarket OS.
For context, Postmarket OS is a community Linux distribution that aims to keep phones running for a decade instead of being locked to the manufacturer's update cycle. The Fairphone 6 is designed to be repairable and long-lasting. Getting the main camera functional bridges a huge gap between a usable daily driver and a proof of concept.
Exactly. The post walks through the process of porting the camera driver from the Android kernel to mainline Linux. It's not just a theoretical hack. They've got it capturing images. For someone in the home lab space thinking about a truly self-hosted mobile experience, this is a significant step forward.
I love the ethos here. It's about reclaiming control over the device. You're not at the mercy of Google or the manufacturer's update schedule. If the community keeps maintaining the driver, this phone could get security updates and new features long after Fairphone stops official support.
The practical implication is you could have a phone that runs your own services, maybe even acts as a mobile server for certain tasks, with a fully functional camera. It's still a niche setup, requiring comfort with flashing devices and debugging drivers, but it proves the concept is moving from possible to practical. The post goes into some technical weeds that are fascinating. They had to write a custom user space component to translate between the Android camera HAL and the Linux V4L2 subsystem. That's not trivial work, and it's a great example of the kind of reverse engineering that makes these projects tick. And for anyone considering the plunge, the author notes the camera works, but advanced features like autofocus and video recording aren't fully implemented yet. It's a milestone, not the finish line. But it does mean you could realistically use this setup for document scanning or basic photography while the rest of the phone runs your own stack.
The author also mentioned they're using a tool called LibCamera as part of the pipeline. That's the modern, vendor-neutral camera stack that's been slowly gaining traction in the Linux world. Getting it working on a mainline kernel with a Fairphone sensor is a vote of confidence for that entire ecosystem.
There's a broader context here, too. Fairphone deliberately publishes hardware documentation and tries to use standard components where possible. That's why this porting effort is even feasible. Compare that to most smartphones, where the camera drivers are proprietary blobs locked to a specific kernel version. This is what right to repair looks like in practice.
The post includes sample images, which is always a good sign. They're not studio quality, but they're clear and properly exposed. That suggests the basic sensor control, setting exposure time, ISO, white balance, is working. The missing autofocus is a limitation, but for static subjects or with manual focus tricks, it's usable.
One interesting detail, the developer had to patch the kernel's device tree to correctly describe the camera sensor's power and clock requirements. That's the kind of low-level hardware knowledge that usually stays inside the manufacturer's SDK. Documenting it publicly means the next person trying this on a similar phone has a roadmap. For the home lab angle, imagine pairing this with something like SyncThing or NextCloud. You take a photo, it syncs automatically to your home server, and your personal photo management pipeline kicks in. No Google Photos, no iCloud. The camera working is the last piece needed for a completely self-hosted mobile photo workflow. Over on the local Llama subreddit, there's a petition that struck a chord. A user is calling for a rule that people posting about model performance must include their quantization levels and hardware specs. It sounds like a minor gripe, but it speaks to a real problem in the local AI community. The post author points out that they constantly see comparisons where someone says a new 27 billion parameter model is underperforming against a 9 billion one, and after digging through comments, it turns out they're running the larger model on a heavily compressed low-bit quant. Right, it's comparing apples to oranges. Quantization, reducing the precision of the model's weights to save memory and speed up inference, has a direct impact on quality. A model running at Q4 might perform very differently than the same model at Q8, or the full unquantized version. Without that context, performance discussions are basically noise. The community reaction in the thread seems largely supportive. It's a push for better scientific rigor in what's often a very experimental, hobbyist space. For anyone running local models in your home lab, this is a good practice to adopt. When you share results, note the exact quant file you used, your GPU or CPU, and memory. It saves everyone time. The original poster gave a concrete example that really drives it home. They saw someone claiming a model was slow and dumb, but it turned out they were running it at Q2 on a CPU with only 8 gigabytes of RAM, while comparing it to a smaller model running at Q8 on a GPU. That's not a model comparison. That's a hardware and configuration comparison, masquerading as one. For hardware, it's not just GPU or CPU. The specific GPU matters. A 490 with 24 gigabytes of VRAM can run models that would spill into much slower system RAM on an 8 gigabyte card. And memory bandwidth matters too. Two GPUs with the same VRAM capacity can have very different token generation speeds based on their memory bus. The thread also surfaced a handy convention. Some users are adopting, listing specs like key4_k4m, 490, 24 GB, 32K context. That's concise and covers the major variables. If that catches on, it will make scanning performance threads much more efficient. This isn't just academic. For home labs with limited hardware budgets, choosing the right model and quantization is a real optimization problem. You want the best performance you can fit in your available RAM and VRAM. Misleading comparisons waste time and could lead someone to dismiss a model that would actually work great for their use case at a different quant level. One commenter linked to a GitHub repo that's trying to create a standardized benchmark suite for local models. That's the logical next step. If we all agree on a few test prompts and tasks and report results with full specs, we could actually build a useful knowledge base instead of just scattered anecdotes.
Here's a quick one that saved me some headaches. Before you deploy a new container or service, especially one you've built yourself, take 30 seconds to run a quick port probe from another machine on your network.
Yeah, it sounds obvious, but it's easy to skip.
You think the service is up because the process is running, but a firewall rule, a bind address, or a misconfigured network mode in Docker can mean it's not actually reachable.
Exactly. Use nc-zv or a simple Python script. The goal isn't a full integration test. It's just to verify the network socket is open and listening. Doing this from a different host catches issues like binding only to localhost when you meant to bind to 0.0.0.0.
It's a tiny habit that can short-circuit a lot of frustrating debugging later. And if you're automating deployments, consider baking this check into your playbook or compose file as a health check step.
The nc-zv command is great because it's usually installed by default on most Linux distributions and even macOS. The syntax is simple. nc-zv hostname port. A successful connection prints succeeded, and it fails fast if the port's closed or filtered. For a slightly more detailed check, you can use nmap-p port hostname with the -st flag for a TCP connect scan. It's more verbose and might not be installed by default, but it can sometimes give you more insight into why a connection is failing. The key is making it part of your workflow. After you run Docker Compose up or systemctl start, before you even open a browser, jump to another machine or terminal and poke the port. It takes seconds, and it either gives you immediate confidence or catches a problem while the setup is fresh in your mind.
That's Home Lab Highlights for Monday. Until next time, happy hosting.